Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello.
And Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Yeah, buddy.
Happy 2015, everybody. It's 2015. Yep. We're 15 years into.
I can't believe it's been 14 years since 9/11. Oh my God.
2025, everybody. Oh, Jesus.
This century is a quarter done.
Oh my God.
We mentioned on the Great Night Bonus podcast that I was watching Cowboy Bebop, and in the background on a hollowed out asteroid in space was an old cantina, and you know it was old in the future because it was established way back in 2025.
Yep. Blade Runner is like 8 years ago.
Yeah.
How far that into the future?
A lot. I'll tell you what, it explains a lot if Blade Runner was 8 years ago.
Yeah. Scott intentionally they adjusted the timeline to kind of make it feel like near, but still in 1982 they're still going like, well, really. But congratulations everybody. We made it 2025.
We did
Hell
it.
Hell yeah. We did it.
We did it, everybody. Did everybody have a good holiday season?
Did. I wonder if the abundance of mental health information on the internet has made possible, like there's just different language that families are able to use that wasn't easily available when I was a kid, and everybody being able to, you know their role and to support. It was one of the happiest Christmases in a minute. It was really great.
Awesome. I did Universal Studios with my wife. Our anniversary is the 30th, and so we spent time with my parents and my brother and my sister-in-law and my nieces. And then we did Universal, which was cool. We had a great experience. All right. Universal tip for everybody.
Here we go.
If you go there, the particularly in Orlando, I don't know what the story is of this. I don't know if it's in LA. I could just look this up, but I won't. I've walked past it a couple times. So I'm like, the Bourne Stuntacular, right? You're like, oh, I need to see a stunt show where they do the old timey. Here's the sound effect and the Wilhelm scream and whatever I had expecting in there. Not it. It's the original, like the T3 theater, which used to be like the Conan theater in LA. But like, anyhow, they do a stunt show, but the way it's done is it's not they're stopping explaining the stunts, is they do like a mini Jason Bourne movie, and they have this digital projection that is the highest quality projection system I've ever seen. It's got to be like a bunch of 4K screens. It is massive. And at first you walk in, you feel like it looks like a concrete wall. Looks like you're looking at a concrete wall. That's the screen. And then the actors play out in front of it, but they have set extensions that come out where, like, you know, at some point the whole scene moves, the digital, you're looking at like Morocco or whatever. And you're like, oh, where is this? You know, you're looking at someplace. Can you hold on 1 second?
I'll tell you what, but everybody's going to be going to Universal probably in the coming year. Do you know why, Brian?
Did they announce some property or something?
It's opening this year. A brand new like 5-world expansion to Universal.
Oh, this is Universal Orlando, right?
Orlando.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I think it's Nintendo World. Well, what's an Epic Universe, man? I know it's Nintendo World, How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah, Nintendo World, How to Train Your Dragon, Dark Universe, which looks super cool. There's a number of sections to it, but I'll finish up the Bourne thing. Sorry, I had a call on my phone that I thought was silenced here. Is they have these set extensions come out, and like at one point, like it opens up where he's like in this fight in like Morocco or something like this, and there's a crowd of people watching the fight. Some of them are digital projections. Some of them are real people. You cannot tell unless you look really closely. Like they do this blending. And then like then he like goes running and then the whole scene moves. He's like walking and talking, scene moves, and they have like top of a building that's in front of the screen. So it just blends in, and they do an action sequence there. They do car chases with cars on like robotic gimbals and stuff in front of the screen. You watch things move. There's a great moment where he's on a motorcycle racing. He jumps up, grabs the streetlight. It's a real actor doing the stunt. And he does this, they do a slow motion thing, and he does like a slow motion pull up, you know, like pull up move over onto it. And you're like, cool. And like, wait, I just watched the guy physically do that stunt in real time.
Well, so, I bet it's much like a good magic trick, this constant negotiation with your brain to establish what is concrete and real and what is suspension of disbelief. And then that's something that Teller would always talk about, is like good magic wrenches permission out of suspension of disbelief. Like if you're on stage, you grab a stick and say, this is a sword. You're like, okay, I'll buy it. This is air quotes, a sword. Whereas in magic, it's like, this is a sword. And then you blink, you're like, holy moly, it is a sword. What just happened?
Yeah, I want to see it again. So I'm not looking for, you know, I'd want to see it multiple times, because the first time my brain can't help but kind of look. It's like I'm watching actors like, oh, I want to appreciate how this was done. So,
oh, that's so funny because I do the reverse. The first time when I go, I totally give myself over to the narrative and I try to let myself get fooled.
Brian, yes. And you do that with magic show and movies. When you go do this, you're not going to be able to help because it's so different. It's such a different thing that normally I do. I just want to immerse it. But because it was I'm like, holy shit, this is a new paradigm. Like it was, I couldn't, because like I'm with the same way with you. Like I want to just not be the magician trying to figure it out. I want to be the audience. But.
How new is this particular show?
I don't know. Let me go look. And I want to say something too, is that like between the Bourne Stuntacular, where you're trying to avoid the CIA, and the Fast and the Furious, where you're trying to escape the FBI raid, there is this sort of interesting vibe there.
Yeah, counterculture, Universal Studios.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably a federal agent. No, I mean, I guess with Transformers, you're escaping the Department of Defense. There really is like, you know, an undercurrent, an anti-authority undercurrent to all of these things.
I guess it's maybe 2 years old.
Also, oh, if you believe the narrative of every theme park,
four, at least four.
Well, I mean, still, that's a blip in terms of, you know, they so build those shows
in 2010
to run.
That's crazy.
Yeah. If you believe the narrative of each one of the theme park rides, I just love that every theme park ride is like, oh no, something's gone terribly wrong. It's like, I have this picture of a credulous review that is like, every single ride I went on, they can't do anything right. There was one where Megatron kicked the door in and screwed everything up. There was another one where Terminator showed up.
Yeah, this was 2020. Yeah, they didn't have this tech in 2010. This was 2020 when this got put in.
I was joking about your joke at the beginning of the podcast.
I know you were, but I want to clarify because I got it. But, you know,
okay.
Too smart. So the parks back to the Epic Universe, they're going to have Super Nintendo World, the How to Train Your Dragon, Isle of Berk, Dark Universe, which is the horror monster theme thing, Wizarding World, which is going to be cool. It's the Ministry of Magic, and then Celestial Park.
Ooh, Celestial Park. Do we know what that one is?
Probably, I don't know. Celestial. Well, remember when, so this is probably the closest to Islands of Adventure, which opened back in the 90s, and that at open had Dr. Seuss World, a kind of very not branded like adventure land, like land of adventure, Jurassic Park. Then I think it was like King Features. So it was like old comics, like the funny.
Yeah,
pages.
That's right. Yeah. Like a Popeye and whatnot.
Popeye and stuff like that. And then
of course, Marvel. Superhero. Which was fascinating, because when I was working Halloween Horror Nights, that's when I would gently ask, like, so seems like Marvel owns a lot of, they just bought Marvel, or Disney bought Marvel, and they're like, yeah, yeah, it's going to be complicated. You know, it's like, these are the comic book character rights. And this was also just as Marvel was kicking on the main scene and they were allowed to make a Spider-Man character who just had a really cool, from the comic books, Spider-Man outfit. And they were internally well pleased that it happened to look like the Sony owned property Spider-Man movie suit on there.
Yeah. That land is still awesome. The Spider-Man ride at Universal is still, like, it has held up on a level that I don't think anybody was probably really expecting, considering it was like bleeding edge tech at the time. But a lot of the rides, including Universal's own like Harry Potter rides, are really kind of just more expensive versions of Spider-Man. And I don't think that they've ever really gotten them better. I think that Spider-Man's probably still, for my money, my favorite version of it. Now, granted, I also went on it a billion times when I was like 16. So there is a strong nostalgia pull for Spider-Man. But there are little things, both with the way that they direct the action, they direct your focus, the physical effects, like when they hit, that are great. And I've never really thought that way about either of the other Harry Potter rides.
Yeah. We talked about this before, that there was an article in Wired magazine in the 90s that came out about the Spider-Man ride when it launched. And it was like all cutting edge then. It was all like, it was doomed to fail, but it did not. It succeeded, like literally one of the best cases of a tech thing that pulled off. And you hear like later on, like the Hagrid ride has issues and a lot of the run times for some of these things go late, because technically, and I can't think of a ride that technically was as big of a leap until, and I would say that like the Bourne Stuntacular though was the first time I felt like I watched, like I said, the video, the background projection was as seamless as I could hope for it, other than if you figured out how to do some holographic depth stuff. They do some other kind of stuff, rides on sound, like the King Kong thing is kind of cool, you know, but you can see the edge of the soundstage and stuff. I do think that really, really good video systems are going to open up really cool things done right. But yeah, the Harry Potter.
Yeah, that's always been the problem with the Harry Potter rides, right? Because they had that kind of tech. I don't think that they was where they wanted it to be. Well, and they were way too ambitious with it.
What I mean is like, you might be able to do a thing where every surface is video and you actually legit like move through there, but you could go through the same space over and over again, rather than keep you in a static space and move you. Yeah. Like I have to close my eyes during the Harry Potter ride, 'cause I get extremely nauseous. The Simpsons ride, the former Back to the Future. I remember I did a VIP tour and they're going to do the Simpsons ride. And they're like, you're like, oh, you want to do this? I said, oh, I'm prone to nausea. Like, oh, we have a person here who's prone to nausea. He's done this. He's fine. I get on the ride. I come out. I'm ready to heave. I'm like, you got to fire that dude, because like I have an entire TV special about how easily I throw up and I swim with sharks.
I'm pumped though. I think Universal's in a prime position because Disney has kind of fumbled the proverbial bag as far as their lead, because really like in the 90s Universal had the best park in Orlando. Disney had stagnated for really the decade prior.
Particularly if you're a teen, is that what you said?
Yeah, if you're a teen, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, you know, Disney was coming out of a really down point in the 90s, right? Like the MGM had kind of floundered.
Disney TV, I guess what this was, I'm going to mix up my timeline. So defunct land, come save us. Late 90s was definitely like, I remember people talking about as Islands of Adventure came out, who are hardcore Disney fans. And they were like bummed the way college football fans are bummed when their team loses a big game, and they console each other like, no, don't worry, we'll get them next year. We got a good thing coming in the pipeline. It's going to be great, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And Disney did a lot to kind of regain that, you know. Animal Kingdom was huge. It was really, really well done. They had good rides that came out of it. But since then, you know, a lot of their last few things have been not great. I mean, like, I know, Brian, you had an amazing experience on Rise of the Resistance, but as that ride gets older in the tooth and, you know, you start to go from, you know, the best person who ever did the Jungle Cruise to the 50,000th person who's doing an impression of that guy 5 years later, 7 years later, I think that doesn't age quite in the same way.
Well, and I think you correctly are pointing out that there was something about my experience that was inextricably tied to
the talent,
the vibe, the excitement of how new it was, and everybody leaning in and giving themselves over to the fantasy of this adventure. And like, it's not even a matter of their performance, because let's say they're all animatronic robots and they're perfect. As we've talked about on this program, I am of the opinion that as AI just gets better and better at mimicking people, we're going to value actual humans even more and more. The one thing you can't fake is that, by God, we're all in this room and this is an incredible spell we're casting on ourselves.
Go ahead.
Well, Brian, I sent a link to you, which is they have a kind of a cool tour of the Disney Ministry of Magic Park where you click through.
Yeah, sure thing. Let me go ahead and get logged in.
I mean, I think that my problem with, you know, Star Wars Land, Galaxy's Edge writ large is that I think it's kind of a failure from the planning stages in terms of what it could be, right? Like, not to say that it's not a fan favorite, because Star Wars is extraordinarily popular. They built a gigantic Millennium Falcon that you can take your picture in front of. That's always going to be popular. But I don't think that the Millennium Falcon ride is anywhere near as good as what it should be. I think Rise of the Resistance is this weird, neither fish nor fowl version of an immersive theater experience and a theme park ride. And they never really were able to figure out, obviously, with their Galaxy Cruiser thing, they had a desire to do immersive theater. They have never really been able to do it. Then they have, you know, the theme park elements of it. But now, you know, you're going to see Universal kind of get, like, for the first time since they've had in the 90s, a real crack at being the toast of the town, which is going to be interesting.
I was a very big Star Wars fan. You know, I've been to, got you guys to come with me to Star Wars Celebration.
Yep.
Very much a fan. And obviously, you know, in some argument made that I aged out of it to an extent, but never been to Galaxy's Edge. The moment when I first heard, I was over the moon. We first did Star Wars, you know, they announced it. And then every announcement about it after the fact made me less and less interested. By the time that it opened, I didn't care. I just didn't care, because meanwhile, Harry Potter, I'm a fan. The Harry Potter world was amazing. You know, you go to, like my wife, who's not a fan of the books or the movies necessarily, we went into the little passageway to get into Diagon Alley.
Yeah.
And Church Spirits, she started smiling. She just felt fun. I'm like, this is cool. Nobody walks into Galaxy's Edge and sees the same red rock that you see at Cars Land.
Yeah.
And what looks like a swap meet on a desert planet that you don't recognize or know, but just has the generic, like there is a generic look to hotels and airports that has the most generic Star Wars thing and gets excited. It's not like you walked in there and you looked up in the sky and saw Cloud City and said, holy cow, I can't wait to go up there to Cloud City. It's not like you heard the sound of a Dagobah swamp and are like, oh my God, I want to explore this. Or you did I think you could do like a Coruscant museum tour where you just walk through exhibits that recreate then remember the whole now is the time kind of thing, like the what if Coruscant, you know, Ministry of, you know, post Star Wars, whatever, had the here's how we got to here. You could do an amazing nostalgia thing that would have just blown people away. And they did, they won. They're like, well, we're going to create new memories, because, you know, a big corporation's really good at creating awesome new nostalgia. And so, that was the thing. I'm looking at this tour. Brian's going through the tours. This is the Ministry of Magic. This is the new Wizarding World Tour at Epic Universe. And you're looking like, oh, this is the European. Well, it's all European. Like, this is like, I guess, like going through the parts there. And you're like, this is an exciting new place to explore.
And so I guess that rounds out their their trinity of, you know, you get Hogwarts, you get Diagon Alley, and then, forgive me, what was the name of this part again?
Ministry of Magic.
Ministry of Magic. Okay, yeah. Got it.
I think this is the French. This is like the French.
Yeah.
Go to the why not? I think the big sleeper hit is going to be Dark Universe. Go do the tour of that.
Okay. So, by the way, we just went to UniversalOrlando.com and they got this way to explore things. I don't know how to back up this.
Go down. If you scroll down, you'll see like tour other parks.
Ah, got it. There we go. Epic Universe. Let's see.
I can send you the link too. Just in case.
Yeah, I might be able to find it. Scrolling on down, Wizarding Paris, and there we go. Sent,
by the way, all right.
Say again.
I sent you the link too.
Oh, great! All right. Well, here I'll jump it over to the three shot while I dig that up.
Yeah. So Dark Universe was Universal decided. You know, they have all these classic movie monsters, and they said, "Let's create our own park." And by the way Epic Universe is laid out, there's one center gateway that you can go to all the different parks from. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a, you know, like.
So are they making, because that was the thing, is that it's kind of far off campus from the other stuff. But I guess as far as the customer journey, you go in through this place and it's a hub. And I imagine there's some magical conveyances once you're on the inside that take you to the different parks.
Well, like for, I mean, within Epic Universe or the other parks?
To get to the other parks. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
But yeah, like I think it's going to be like a bus thing.
The most epic of conveyances, a bus.
Yeah.
So we're looking at the Dark Universe. This was supposed to be kind of their answer to the MCU with your Frankensteins and Wolfsmen and mummies.
Well,
it has
nothing to do with that IP. Nothing to do with that IP at all.
Oh, really?
So I mean, no, it has to do with the original.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not their new Dark Universe. This is. I mean, they use the name, but it's
okay.
Yeah, but this is taking the classic monsters that Universal has always been very, very proud of, and doing new, original rides based on those properties. But they look awesome. There's like a great new Frankenstein one, a great Wolfsman one.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, so I mean, it just looks like a very, very amazingly themed place, and
I'll tell you what, you know, we tend to be I don't know, pragmatic folks, the three of us, but danged if we don't also recognize that humans are narrative driven creatures, and the fact that like so many people pay so much money and move their bodies in order to all be in the same place and engage in play pretend for stories is just so extraordinary. Like, to the tune that the corporation has to tell shareholders, don't worry, enough humans are going to come here and play pretend. I guess Brian says, as the three of us continue our phony baloney jobs by telling stories on the internet.
Brian, you just passed it, but that's like apparently the big centerpiece for the Dark Universe thing is their gigantic, constantly on fire windmill.
Oh, so you know what? I was not thinking in terms of practical effects. To me, that was just one cool, it is a constantly on fire windmill.
Yeah, no, so that's just going to be a thing, is that windmill is just going to be on fire all day.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we do all these things remotely. We should consider maybe every now and then doing something in the same space.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. What do you think? You got anything next week, Brian?
Oh, my
Brian,
goodness.
How's next Friday look for you for us to do like...
All right. The pieces are coming together. You know what? I'm not making any plans for next Friday, my birthday.
Well, then what do you say we... I was trying to think of this. Have we ever done, I guess, you want to know what? For Star Wars Celebration, we were all in the same room.
Yeah, and we recorded our thoughts immediately. Oh, sweet summer children we were. So very excited.
But other than that, I don't know if I can remember a time where we've all been in the same room doing weird things.
Not the Weird Things podcast,
the podcast.
Well, anyway, that's going to happen live on the internet next week.
Yeah, and you know what? We're so dedicated to it that Brian's not going to watch Severance on his birthday, season 2.
No, we appreciate that. I'm looking at how.
Why, I mean, do you have to? Are you like trying to atone?
No. I think it was funny a couple days ago when you asked Justin like if I had any plans or don't make any plans. I was like, for months ever since they announced the premiere of season two, I was like, that's my birthday, and so I made a joke that that's what January 17th is going to be all about.
Yeah. Well, you're still allowed to do it.
Okay.
You know, yeah, there's no quid pro quo here. You can wake up and watch Severance as soon as you wake up.
I'm looking at how far away Epic Universe is from the other Universal parks.
It's pretty far.
Yeah, you've got like neighborhoods and plazas and all sorts of stuff in between there.
Yeah, let me see if I can pull it up on Google Maps.
Yeah, for folks who are not familiar with Orlando's geography, one of the things that obviously Disney, you can listen to the origin of this on World's Greatest Con, was very prescient of is buying a gigantic swath of land in the adjacent area to Orlando. Universal built kind of in the center of Orlando. So unfortunately, if they want to expand, there is stuff all around it in a way that Disney could probably just keep building one new park a year for, you know, decades and never run out of space that they already own.
Yeah. So audio listeners, if you we're looking right now at Universal Orlando Resort is practically touching, you know, all of the parks are all practically touching, or actually, yeah, there's a road separating them and that's it. Which way do I go to navigate to the new park? South?
Yeah.
Okay. So past the Endless Summer Resort.
Yeah, I mean you're past Sand Lake Road. I mean
So is it north or south from the park?
South. The Epic Universe is south east.
Okay. Yeah.
You've got the Lockheed plant. You've only got a Lockheed, you know, defense facility there,
which is its own immersive experience.
Oh, is this it under construction here? Wow, that is a ways. Yep. It's down south past Universal's food and beverage warehouse.
Yeah, I think that was the land that they used. They used other land that they had used as auxiliary support for the park to build another park.
That's amazing. Yeah. And it's launching when?
I think May.
This spring. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so in for that.
Yeah. Then you go look at like Disney property and you're like, oh yeah, they've just got a ton. You know, they've got all this other land and everything else. You know, they could have.
They are not anywhere close. They could just continually expand like the universe and they would not get close to their boundaries.
Yeah, you look over there and you see tons of land, swamp land, and then you're like, oh, there's Animal Kingdom. Like, oh, they're in the middle of nowhere. It's the Reedy Creek Environmental Service, you know, services. You know, like, it's just crazy.
I'll tell you what, I hope that Epic Universe is a massive hit, and I hope that it lights a fire under Disney's ass. I hope that you know, the appropriate people are shaken up and, you know, the next things that they look to do are a little bit more... a little bit sharper.
Yeah, we'll see. 2024, let's talk about that year for a moment.
Yeah, let's do it.
It was rapid AI. I think 2024 is a year that everybody started going, most everybody like, oh yeah, maybe this AGI thing could happen.
Well, yeah, that was my prediction, right? Was that we would get people announcing AGI in the interregnum between that episode and this one. You had leadership at OpenAI saying that they were already moving their eye line away from AGI and up to ASI, a super intelligent system.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's been, we'll see what's going to happen next with the rate. Everything's going to be a jagged frontier. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens with that. A thing that came out since we last talked is, you know, NVIDIA, the Consumer Electronics Show, a big area to look into. And I've talked about this before, how systems like Sora and whatever, they're actually like world simulators, which have uses for applications like physics and stuff. And NVIDIA just launched a thing called Cosmos, an open source model you can run locally. And what it does is it lets you simulate a lot of different environments in which a robot would work. And that was like the point I've been trying to explain before was like, these things are really useful. If I want to have a robot system and train it and basically have it understand how to navigate a warehouse or a kitchen. And so they've launched those, their Cosmos Rolled Frontier models, which are really, really cool. So if you go to, I'll send you this link, Brian, if you don't have it.
Sure.
And you can see the example, the kind of video footage. So it's generative AI. So it means that it's just, it's generating it on the fly. And what it's done, it, what you want to be able to do is if you're trying to train a robot system with vision, trying to run an experiment in the real world is obviously ideal. The problem is if you're trying to iterate and improve it. If it takes you, you know, the problem Boston Dynamics had is that, you know, it takes them 20 minutes to set the robot up on top of the harness and put it in the environment. And then all of a sudden you realize that somebody forgot to oil an ankle mechanism and now you've got to restart. That is a problem with the physical world. The physical world does not move as fast as software because it's hard to do it. The more accurately your software can replicate the physical world, the faster you can iterate on hardware.
Okay, and, here we go. So I just got the link. Let me get that open. But we're looking at, this is an NVIDIA, by the way. Okay, so where am I headed on this link?
Just look at the video, just the video that it's showing.
Uh-huh.
So what we're looking at here, this is just, it's a new video model that generates all these different scenarios and situations. So you can basically, it's designed for training robots.
Oh, that's great.
So all so those
you can, so as you are giving it data of what the real world is, it can physically generate that data. So it is smarter in the real world.
Yeah. I could go say, hey, create a virtual warehouse for me. Now give the signal, the input back to my AI as I tell my AI model to try to navigate the warehouse, the virtual warehouse. And so I could run thousands of simulations inside of a virtual warehouse, then put the actual robot into the real warehouse to see how well it's able to do that.
Well, and there's a temptation, or I'm not going to say temptation. A few years ago, I would have been worried about like, wait, well, maybe it's just making everything up. But reading Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Nearer, he explains like, look, yes, it's synthetic data, but it's based on physics models and basically is creating a gigantic data set of real situations, or at least close enough to real expected situations. And then when it's trained upon that, it will have the heuristic to automatically know how to handle everything from emergency situations to logistics management.
Yeah, because the point is just because people are like, oh, it's not real. It's like, well, I can build my robot, just put it in the real world, or I can build my robot, put it into the virtual world, then the real world.
Yes.
Yeah. Because if the first time in my virtual world, it doesn't know what an ambulance is and it drives right through it, then that's bad.
Example that I got to touch recently was I'm still in this process of doing this series of explaining the kind of counterintuitive aspects of flipping a weighted coin and why, even though it's weighted in your favor, you shouldn't do it. But in order to kind of Monte Carlo prove it, you know, tens of thousands of virtual coin flips, it's all synthetic data that using OpenAI ChatGPT Pro mode, it's like it's got the receipts and it does line up with the expected values of all this, but by virtue of being actual coin flips, you can show it deviating, you know, in one random seed versus another random seed. It's a similar game to that, only like all things being equal, which robot would you like on your production floor? The one who has practiced a lot in a virtual environment or the one who's his first day on the job?
And that's the promise. The promise here is that a lot of these things are just going to be able to scale up so much faster. Boys, I hate to bail, but there's a fussy baby that I need to go corral right now. But I will say that my pick, speaking of robots, is the new defunct land about audio animatronics. If you've not seen it.
I watched just the very beginning of it and I got so excited. I didn't want to watch it in less than an ideal environment.
Two things that are amazing. One of the greatest Disney quotes of all time that has a great card for it. You will know it when you see it. And
I wonder if I may have been one of the ones that I photograph I took a screenshot of.
I got one too. And I've just been waiting for the moment that I could use it in a conversation. We've probably just been waiting for one of us to do something. It's just Walt Disney saying no. It's just like his face and just slowly comes up no. And so,
but fun, it's a fact, great. After this call or tomorrow, I have to have a video call. I have to have a conversation. I have a call with, I backed a film that one of the editors was a producer on.
That, and then Walt Disney holding a gun on the Jungle Cruise, which is amazing.
Yeah.
I actually just want that high resed up, just a massive photo of that in my office forevermore. I will see you boys down the road. Later.
Awesome. Well, here, we'll keep things the way they are for just a second, and then I'll set up a shot with the two of us.
The close-up shot? This is me.
Although, you know what? I'm okay with this, too.
Welcome to Oz!
Okay, let me zoom you in, and then I'll just pan you over. There we go. And, sure. We'll go with this for now. we'll make it right. For now, we'll have as big a heads as we often do. You know what? I can fix that. So AI. Okay, so I got a question for you, Andrew. You and I, during this AI revolution, we have an emerging market, and we have been of the opinion, I think we're on the same page, that now is a time to be peak, nimble, and flexible, because everybody knows that AI is going to be big, like the internet was. Nobody knows which will be the killer app or the way to win on the internet / AI, that kind of similar parallels. So I have been saying yes to an awful lot of subscriptions for AI. And I just got a notification that at some point in a frenzy, one of the things that I subscribe to, like the credit card was maxed out. And so it says, this thing, I think it was Suno, was declined. And I'm like, Suno? Man, I've been on Udio for a while. And so I realized that I'm experiencing AI subscription fatigue. And I think I'm going to cull everything. And similar to what I advise people to do when it comes to cutting the cord, cancel everything. And then the moment I want something, resume it, with the one exception of OpenAI ChatGPT, because I'm still using that one every single day. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I think that, you know, I'm all for, sometimes I have subscriptions to stuff and I let them keep going because I kind of like the company. I want to keep it going, but you know, I don't know if they would return the thing. And I like Udio, but I have not used Udio forever. And I'm like, oh, do I need to keep throwing there? And I probably have some subscriptions thrown around there. I think you just play with stuff. Like I have, I liked Bolt.new for creating apps, but it won't work on my phone. And then I discovered Lovable.dev, which works on my phone. And then I'm like, oh, well, maybe they should have my business right now.
Yeah, I'm going to have to unsubscribe to Bold.new. That was a delightful 2 days of me believing I wanted to be a programmer. And I may go back to it. So here's the funny part is we talked about the fact that no matter, for years we've had all these smart home systems that we've all waited with bated breath to find out whether or not this one would play along with that one or what have you. And so, but now we have this situation where you can write, anybody could be a programmer now and write scripts to control stuff. So most of what I'm doing with the Stream Deck and the vMix and setting up this new studio is all within one ecosystem. But then I bump into, for example, the lights all like Bluetooth, and there's not an easy thing to set up except for like, I would have to write a custom script. And that would have been the end of the discussion a year ago, certainly 2 years ago, but now it's not. Now it's like, well, I guess I'll just learn to program now and have an AI walk me through that as well.
Yeah, I had a problem with just transferring like a lot of stuff. I was building an app to like generate video slides, and I had a problem with converting, you know, once you do like WebM or something like that, which WebM works fine in Chrome, and that's the only place WebM works on a Mac. And I have a conversion tool, and I'm like, okay, I can go into the conversion tool and all that. I'm like, oh, ChatGPT lets me write Apple scripts now, you know, which are kind of like, power, you know, stuff that you can do, like, you know, Windows has their version. I said, oh, let me see if I can open up Automator and write a script. And it took me 6 minutes. And then I had a working thing and a menu selection that I can just click on a file and say, convert. It's done. It opens up the app in the background, does that. Now it's, you know, ChatGPT just made it super easy to do that.
What's been the latest, or give me a sampling, because nobody's farther on the bleeding edge of this stuff than you are. Give me a sample of what's on your radar these days.
Broadly speaking, reasoning models 01, 03, those are useful because we're finding out there's a lot of areas where AI is kind of sometimes good, but isn't always super reliable. And the reasoning models are really, really useful for that. And, you know, reasoning models, you know, basically we talked about how those work before, but, you know, they can kind of go back and say, oh, let me try this again. You know, the talk, of course, right now, and if you listen to us, we talked about this over a year ago as agents, and now people are like, agents. And we're like, yes, if you listen to the show, you'd know about it. The next thing from there is going to be networks. And what we mean by that is we laid out a lot of really cool infrastructure with crypto, with a lot of BS and dumb things and blockchain stuff. But man, if I want to have a tool that's able to like pay 3 cents or a fraction of a cent to go use a thing or whatever and just kind of run in the background, a lot of that infrastructure is going to be useful now. And you're going to start thinking about, like, if you said, you know, Brian, you were like, oh, I have to, you know, I need to get X, or I want to get this video edited or something like that. And it might be, you know, an agent system might be able to do it. Or you might have an agent that talks to another agent that's really good at video editing and negotiates a price because some of them are, you know, the same, whatever. And like, I don't know how far we get there this year, but that'll be a thing. Reasoning systems, agents, putting the stuff everywhere, AI-powered browsers. There's a number of companies trying to work on this, a browser. Anything that you can do in a browser, have an AI take over and do.
I have noticed something interesting with cutting-edge products. Like I'm buying, again, a lot of this studio equipment, and sometimes I don't know whether or not it's supposed to do that out of the box, whatever that is. And when I search for the product name and look for like just sort of impressions people have, it used to be back in the day, it would take me to a bunch of public forums and Google would be helpful for that. Nowadays, over the last 5 years, it's increasingly just taken me to Reddit threads. But now I'm not even seeing a lot on Reddit threads, and I, you know, obviously people are buying these products and obviously they're having an experience, but all of a sudden those experiences and those questions that what I want is confirmation to know whether or not my experience is common to them as well. But now all of that is opaque because people are asking their personal agent AIs, and that personal agent is not in the business of sharing that with me. So I'm wondering what the downstream effects of that will look like when it used to be that you would just shout into the void of the internet and another person shouting for the same thing would find you. And that's less and less now. I wonder if there'll be sort of a synthetic anonymized version of Reddit where, like, maybe OpenAI calls it OpenAI's town square. And basically the idea is nothing could ever be traced back to the individual person, but instead an avatar representing 1,000 people asking similar questions is in the town square. So like, I want to talk to the avatar of somebody who also bought this and ask like, and then have it speak trained on all of those questions that everybody's asking their AI agent.
We are going to be paying a lot of attention to where information gets siloed and how we network and make it available. And it certainly might be a thing where you let your AI build up stuff, information. Like, remember one of these kind of far science fiction novels, I forget what it was called, but basically involved the civilizations where we never broke speed of light, right? And we'd have these kind of armadas that would, and people, we had longevity though, and people would travel around the galaxy.
Was the Forever War?
No, not that. Not the ripoff that he claimed he didn't know there was such a book called Forever War. it was a very good writer, but that was a long story short. Scalzi wrote a thing with the same premise. Like, I didn't know the Forever War. Like, how are you in sci-fi and you didn't know Forever? I believe you. I'm just amazed.
Okay. That's well, welcome to Brian Walks It Back.
Yeah. So no, this was like kind of a post-singularity kind of thing. And what it would be is like armadas would come into other contacts with other cultures and trade, and they would trade information and they would trade back and forth. And you would go to the next one and you'd trade information and you know, petabytes of information about art, mystery, movies, whatever. And that was the thing, was that just like this idea that it's just this consistent flow of information going around the galaxy, and there was a value there. And I'm saying that here is that you might say, hey, I trust my AI, every product, everything I've used, whatever. Yeah, create it, you know, maybe you just create a public good database, but maybe I'm like, no, I want to I'll trade this. And so somebody could say like, hey, you know, I want to know, I want to talk to 100 people, 100 AIs that work for people that have the new Mavox, you know, video generation sequence, because I have questions. And behind the scenes, it does a negotiation and says, yeah, for 0.3 cents, I will share what I know. And all of a sudden it comes back to the answer. And you could say, I think there could be networks like that. I think we could create. And this goes back to, by the way, one of the original protocols for the internet was the idea that we went to the sort of default, I get to access your server, and not I default have to pay you for access to this. But there was the idea that maybe every exchange on the internet should be a financial transaction. Or a lot of people are like, oh, it shouldn't be. It's like, well, it is at some point a financial transaction, that we did not eliminate the need for money or computer energy. We just shoved it in other places. And so every time you get an image on your computer, it's coming from an Amazon S3 bucket, somebody's paying a price, whatever, and it's fractions of cents, so much people don't monitor it. But there is this idea of like, oh, well, if it's more efficient, because in the long run, the kind of the perverse thing is that like, you may be paying way more for stuff now than you realize, because people are making guesses about what things are going to cost or whatever. And sometimes there's an inefficiency.
Yeah, ultimately, all of those misses that subsidize the hits, they all get paid for in that final retail price. And so if we can have, you know, eliminate, you know, 90% of the misses, all of a sudden you could pay half the retail cost for all of this stuff.
Yeah, and sometimes too, you might find out that, you know, there's terabytes of somebody's got reserve bandwidth that can't be used because they're afraid they might need it. Then that, it's a wasted resource. So there's a lot of efficiency there. I would say the other thing to think about though is, you know, the makers of the device might throw it at an AI and say, hey, pretend you're 1,000 users using this and tell me what's going to happen. That would be, I think that's the likely scenario, is we're going to find out that like, you build an app and you give it access to a bunch of agents and the agents go through there and do it. And maybe somebody third party says, you know, we'll do this. And like, because that's one of the things I thought about, like you could probably write your help docs by letting another AI system try to use the system, you know, not build it from my code outwards, but like literally build it from the outside in of like, oh, here, whatever.
Well, and think about what a difference. So you and I both came from the world of magic, and before, you know, obviously the internet changed a lot, including the discussion about how magic should handle information. And of course, magicians, to varying sliding degrees, rely on information inefficiencies in order to, as they put it, preserve wonder, as others might put it, preserve their cartel. In general, you would consume information of magic of here's the effect, this is the secret, the end. And then along with that, in order to negotiate teaching magic in a public and quasi-public environment, you still have to click on it. With Scam School, originally it was just to accommodate two sponsor breaks, but I added a C block. So it was like, perform the trick, make it look really good, teach how the trick is done. And then the C block was allow somebody picked out of the wild, a random person at the bar. And if they could learn the trick, number one, along the way, they're going to make
the type of mistakes they'll make will be exactly the type of mistakes that people at home are likely to make. And therefore it'll be valuable experience to watch them work their way through it and get it down. And that provided two things. Number one, it provided proof that this was teaching and not exposure. Number two, it provided valuable information of, hey, a lot of people are going to make this mistake and so on. And what you're describing with 1,000 newbies doing it is like an efficient at scale version of the same things. And so along with that, you can smell those precursors to a mistake coming, where it's like, what are the moves people make that indicates that they're likely on a track where they're going to encounter the real problem? And what nudges to the UI can be made to guide them to the intended effect?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways that you can just like we say, yeah, it's exactly like the robotics thing. It's like, literally, let me simulate this, because so many problems you don't find out until much, much later on that, you know, would have been easily discoverable had you been looking at it from a different point of view.
Yeah.
All right, picks.
Yeah, you know what? I just did an hour plus conversation on this one with Andrew Heaton on his Alienating the Audience podcast. It'll go out next week. And originally, he was asking if I wanted to talk about Fallout. And so he was in town. I sat down and rewatched, you know, for the fourth time, Fallout Season 1, Episode 1. And we were discussing kind of the morality of Fallout and how it's like you have all of these laboratories, without getting into too many spoilers, you have laboratories for all these moral conundrums. That's what the game was built on, and what happens when you hit the reset button on humanity. But we made all these plans to talk about Fallout and ended up not at all talking about Fallout because of one moment. We get to the part where we're meeting Maximus from the Brotherhood of Steel, and Andrew casually asks, so I guess what these guys thing is, like, I guess they're just obsessed with pre-war artifacts. Why? And I was like, I mean, that's just straight out of A Canticle for Leibowitz. And he said, what? And I was like, you haven't read A Canticle for Leibowitz? And he's like, no. And I was like, dude, you got a 18-hour drive ahead of you. Do that audiobook, and that'll be what we talk about. And so I went back and I listened to the audiobook, most of the audiobook for A Canticle of Leibowitz. I also listened to the last bits in the NPR radio play based on A Canticle for Leibowitz. And that's my pick, A Canticle for Leibowitz. It was patient zero of the apocalypse genre. It was, I think, I don't know... I know that Fallout traces, you know, is a sequel, spiritual successor to Wasteland. Wasteland drew upon the imagery of Stephen King's The Wasteland, and of course, you know, A Boy and His Dog, and Mad Max, and all of them owe a deep, deep debt to A Canticle for Leibowitz. Once you go all the way back to that, I don't know how much farther back it goes, because A Canticle for Leibowitz was written as a series of science fiction short stories in a sci-fi magazine, and they eventually got made into this novel. It spans, you know, 1,000+ years, and it's great. And in fact, I think that's all I want to say. There are three main characters. There's the world, there's the Catholic Church, and there's entropy. It's a battle of those three things.
Yeah, I read it back in high school, and it's one of those things, like, I need to go back and listen to it again, because there's this weird recommendation blind spots. When you ask for recs on stuff, and algorithms, I think, have a big problem with this, because you'll go, like, I look for something like this, 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 and then you go through and you get the same sort of 20 or 30 recs over and over again. And then you come across something else, like, why did it not, you know, if you look for like vampire movies, you know, on Netflix or Amazon would recommend stuff that's like everywhere, you know, you might never see Shadow of a Vampire, you know, you might never see like, was the John Landis.
Shadow of the Empire. Vampire. That was the the book that, was it Timothy Zahn? No, it was somebody else.
Shadow of the Vampire.
Shadow of Vampire. Sorry, I think you said Shadow of the Empire.
No,
which
no,
was one of the Star Wars books that, yeah.
Which was a great book, by the way. But yeah, No, this was a one about a what if Mac, when they shot the original Nosferatu, what if Max Shrek was actually like a vampire? Fun premise, whatever. There's a lot of like, yeah, there's a lot of these. Oh, it's a vampire movie. But if I go do a list of name me 20 vampire movies, it may never come up, you know, and it goes for the more popular. Like we have the saying, like Canonical of Leibowitz, like I've been looking at for like more classic sci-fi stories to revisit. And I read this years ago. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to add this to my list because I need to go back and read it again because I don't think I've read this thing in 25 years.
Yeah.
If you want a cool series, I don't know if you've ever read it, but if you want some other early stage, do you know the genre Dying Earth?
No, I don't. Let's pretend I don't.
Dying Earth genre, and one of the more prominent writers that was Gene Wolfe. The Dying Earth genre is basically the idea that you take it like, what about the Earth 100,000 years, a million years in the future? What happens if you go to the point at which, hey, the sun's starting to change a bit, whatever, but there's still people? Like, what is the deep, 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 deep future history like for that? And because it's a very crazy thing to think about. We're good at, you know, we can imagine a few hundred years because we go back, looking back, you know, a few hundred years. Like maybe imagine, maybe we do have trouble. We start to say like Star Trek Discovery started to do like the year 3000 and stuff. And I'm like, that's just, I'm sorry. Like that's, there's like a, you know, I think they may be doing a new series like that. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like that's a really hard thing to think about, especially now when we don't even have a good idea what the year 2100 is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you try to do that, but I think what some of these places do is like, well, we'll just imagine civilization collapses and comes up again. Cause that's how you do Dune. That's how you do Foundation, is you basically say, we reset everything. And then we arrest everything at some time period that sort of feels familiar to you. But to really think of like, because we try to think of like, what would it be like 10,000 years now of technological progress? I can't wrap my head around it. So Dying Earth is the idea of like, you go 100,000 years in the future, whatever. And it's just like medieval, but there's mutants and monsters and just all sorts of stuff. And you don't even have, it's not even like you have like sort of Shannara or whatever. You have the remnants of like R. So, you know, we're everything we have is dust. Like there's just no evidence that of our time period, because there's been epic periods of humanity's history going forward. So anyhow, Shadow of the Torturer is one of the books Gene Wolfe wrote. The Book of the New Suns, the series.
Cool. All right. Gene Wolfe, you said?
Yeah, Gene Wolfe. So my pick is two picks. I saw Wicked last night. If you like musicals, you're gonna love Wicked.
Hey Andrew, do you like musicals?
I thought production design is fantastic, acting's cast the great, the music was great, everything's like that. But like for me, it's like, I'm not going to go to a tractor pull and say it was too noisy. So I'm not going to go into this and go like, I'm like 30 minutes into it. Like,
it's really good phrase. I really like that.
Yeah. Negative thing is it's a musical, you know, I am sure it's probably one of the better ones. What I really want to rave about, and I rave in the sense that like, don't go in there and be like, oh my God, it's blowing me away. Thanks, Andrew. I'm like, no, like just solid movie. I dug the hell out of it. Loved it. Was Nosferatu.
Yeah, it's just a classic retelling of the classic story, or?
Yeah, so the original Nosferatu in 1922 was an example of, you know, like German expressionism based, sort of like literally taking sort of a painting style and using that how you would do certain, like creating nightmares, sort of set design, etc., and whatever. It was basically, they did not have the rights to Bram Stoker's Dracula. So they took Bram Stoker's Dracula, got rid of a couple plot lines, changed a couple things, but it's effectively the story, the going to sell real estate to the Count, but it's Count Orlok and it takes place in Germany. And he's not named Harker. His name's another close name. So it was, it was artistically, you know, very high water mark. Bram Stoker's widow sued the producers of the original Nosferatu. All the copies were supposed to have been destroyed, but they weren't. Which is why we have it today. And now the copyright's expired, we can see that. So Robert Eggers, he did Witch. He did Lighthouse, which I saw. I thought Witch was great. He did this. I love it because he has a strong idea as a director. He is making, you know, a really good director is making choices, and they're making their own choices. And that's what I liked about it. And there's camera movements and stuff in here that is really, really nice, the way he shot it. He embraced some of the aesthetics of the early one, but he wasn't trying to make an impressionistic film, which I liked. It's atmospheric. It's moody. I really dug the hell out of Nosferatu.
Right on. Well, yeah, and that's in theaters or streaming or?
In theaters now.
Awesome. I'll check it out.
And it is funny, too, that like you think about like the 1922 version, you know, got sued almost out of oblivion. And 100 years later, you know, we're watching a $50 million
reboot or a reimagining of because finally the copyright has expired.
Well, because it was all good. I mean, you could do Dracula. Dracula's out of copyright now. And so you could easily do Dracula if you want. But, you know, Eggers like, no, I want to do Nosferatu, which I thought was a great choice. It's like Billy Skarsgård, by the way, plays Count Orlok. Great. Just great.
Cool.
Yeah. Cool. It's been weird.